it's late now. The House Committee on Revenue for May 12, 2015 will come to order. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2316. Mazin, is that yours?
Yes, sir.
Please.
Chair, members, committee, the House Bill 2316 comes to you from the Committee on the Judiciary, and what the bill does in general, it does two things, two main issues. The revenue issue is one of them, and that basically takes the increases for fees in the justice courts. So this is a justice courts fee increase bill, and accordingly it's a three-fifths vote bill. And you have, as in your bill statement in section one, is most of the bill increases that you would have. Then you also have the all these bill increases to be effective on October 1st of 2015, and then you have further increase coming on January 1st, 2018 of the small claims going again from $35 to $37. And then, of course, there is also an increase in the trial fee for $100. That's the large increase that you have. So that's the revenue decision, or that revenue issue that you have in this bill from the counties. The other one is about the material witness issue and the order of that, and that is all the judicial have discussed, and I guess sent it your way to look into the revenue issue.
Great. So the issue that we are facing mostly has to do with the fees. Is that right?
That is correct, Mr. Chair. Fee increases for the justice courts, for the county courts.
All right. And we should assume that the previous committee, Judiciary, has already dealt with the other issue. And did they send it with a due pass?
They did with an eight yeses and
okay. One no. So we're going to limit our discussion to the revenue issues involving fees and stay away from the judiciary questions. Thank you. Let's see. We have three people signed up, and I think I'll take them by what my suspicion is their position is on it. David Reinhart, Patrick Sen first. All right, Matt, you can come up too.
Great, thank you.
The laugh did it.
Matt, do you want to start?
Sure. I'll start. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt
Markey. So much for my thought about that.
Representing the Oregon Collectors Association.
Yes.
Throughout the process in the House Judiciary Committee, Representative Barker took some time for us to work together on a fee package. The fees as originated in a different bill actually were substantially higher than this. We worked together with the proponents of the bill to try to craft some fees that were more reasonable to everybody, and we all agreed upon what you see in House Bill 2316. I was able to get our client to be okay with these fee increases, as they are tend to be high users of the court system. So with that, Mr. Chair, happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Gentlemen.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Dave Reinhart here representing Linn County and Deschutes County. We worked with Mr. Markey on this bill. It is a compromise. It's not everything we would have asked, we had asked for, but we support the bill. I note that Mr. Markey is neutral, which will tell you how the negotiation went. But we appreciate the committee's support.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Patrick Singh. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties, and we're here in support of House Bill 2316 as well, which was, as mentioned, a collaborative effort between our associations. Lynn and Deschutes, of course, two of the hardest hit counties when it comes to justice court revenues in recent years. And as Mr. Marquis mentioned, we started discussion about this bill in the interim. It was originally House Bill 2355 with much higher fees, probably closer to what the circuit courts charge. So we want to thank Mr. Reinhardt and Mr. Marquis and their associations on working in this bill. Just some background, we have 26 justice courts in Oregon. They provide an invaluable service to our local constituents as a local court option. In addition to traffic violations and some misdemeanor crimes, many justice courts also do some of these civil filings. And I think due to the economic downturn, we've seen a very steep increase in a lot of the filings that happen in justice courts, which has caused kind of a backlog in time and labor needs at the court, which have caused revenue declines for the counties and the courts. So in OLIS, you'll see a graph of what the current justice court fees are under our testimony, current circuit court fees, and then what the bill proposes. So in order to continue the service for our local citizens, we hope that you will pass the bill. Thank you very much.
Okay. I'm looking up that document you were just describing. This is it for this bill, so if there are questions, now's the time.
Sure.
Yes, Representative Langer, please.
I just want to thank you three for being up here, and you've clearly done a lot of work together to get to a place where all three of you are able to be supportive or neutral, and thank you for doing that. It seems like important changes that I look forward to supporting.
Okay. Where does the money go when collected in these fees? Where does it get deposited? How is it spent?
Well, Dave Reinhardt for Linn County, it goes into the maintenance and operations of the justice courts, and the problem is that not enough goes into it, and our counties have to basically subsidize these operations, and it is a money loser for the currently, and this is a bill that would make it less of a drain. But it comes out of general funds for the county governments, and it's money that could be used elsewhere by the county.
Okay, so the funds for these courts go into the county coffers. The county then pays the costs of the justice courts. Did I hear that correctly, or did I misunderstand that?
You've got it correct.
Okay. And this applies to all cases except criminal cases. Is that right?
I'm looking there are some criminal cases.
I'm looking at line 10, page 2. But that may be okay, please, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think there are potentially some criminal cases on line 6 and 7, the first page, but it's not what you're thinking of. I don't believe it is, like traffic citations and things like that. Those are handled differently with a different split of how that money works.
Did you want to answer that?
No, Mr. Chair.
At this point, I'm just trying to understand how this all fits together from a financial point of view. You three have obviously spent a lot of time figuring this out. Please.
The those fees, Mr. Chair, are for the county courts or the justice courts. The way the system for the state courts, that you have the CFA additional fee, not only comes on the criminal and the traffic tickets.
Right.
So those fees are primarily the ones that fund and go to the counties and stay there without having any slices going in different places.
Right. Those criminal cases are, we're talking about fines and fees, aren't we, that result after conviction. Here we're talking about filing fees.
That's right.
And a variety of other things instead. So that hence the Oregon Collectors Association's interest.
Correct.
Because they file in these courts.
Yes. Correct, yes. Absolutely.
That is okay.
Representative Vega Peterson and then Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So thanks for all the work on this. This is a little bit outside my wheelhouse, so most of these changes are just for a few dollars, but it looks like the biggest changes, the big change really is for the trial fee for a trial by jury or a trial without jury from $17 to $100. Can you just give me a little information on you know, why the jump to $100 from $17?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm happy to attempt that. I think jury trials are probably their most expensive to do. The fee has been relatively low for a long period of time, and that was an area that we all, as we discussed it, felt that an increase of that magnitude was legitimate because of the sheer cost of doing so. One thing that even when you look at the circuit court system is never self-sufficient with the fees that they generate. I mean, our general fund within the state helped supply our state court system. And from my client's perspective, we think the county court system should work in the same way. But with that one particular fee, it just is one area where it's very costly to do so.
And I might add that these fees have not been adjusted much. They've been adjusted, I think, on two occasions over the past 20, 30 years. And thus you see that jump. Which I grant you is eye-catching.
Yeah. And follow up?
Yes, please. Yes.
And then it's 100 for a trial by jury or trial without jury. It's both 100. So is it just because they're
I'm wondering if those are cumulative or only one of those fees gets paid. It looks like the defendant gets to pay the jury fee if the defendant asks for the jury, but the plaintiff will pay the trial fee if there is no jury. That's two and three, right. Lines
43, 44.
On page two. And thank you, Representative Vega Peterson, for catching that one.
Mr. Chair, it was my understanding. I thought that that both sides paid that fee, but I am not 100% certain of that. I don't think there are a lot of jury trials within the justice court system to begin with, but I am not an expert on the justice court myself. So
I think Carl Meyer is here. He might be able to answer that. Question.
Well, that would be helpful. Representative Vance, did you have a question on a different topic?
A different topic.
Why don't you raise your question, then we'll ask this one of Carla?
I think it's Carl.
Carl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious how the Section 7 ended up in this bill. Like it was added in.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that has nothing to do with any of the three of us. But that happened on the pretty close to the last day of the deadline in the House Judiciary Committee. There was a discussion. I'm not even sure, to tell you the truth, if anybody came in to testify about that. But it was adopted by the House Committee, but nothing with respect to us here.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Thank you.
Okay. Please, you're ready to answer my question, Representative Vega Peterson's question, that would be helpful. It certainly appears, just from the way the thing is drafted, that the plaintiff pays $100 for a trial per day unless the defendant wants a jury trial, or either of them want a jury trial, and then the fee is $100 payable by that person.
Yeah, I think you're right.
That's what it says here. Now, that may not be the intent. But
yeah, that's what it reads.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Carl Myers. I am a municipal court judge, but I'm also here representing the Justices of the Peace and, excuse me, the Municipal Judges Associations. In answer to your question, I do believe those are cumulative. Jury trials do cost considerably more, So there's a one fee if they want a trial. There's another fee if they want a jury trial. I think that's only fair because of the additional costs of handling and managing a jury. But I can tell you from experience, collection agencies never have a jury. Most others don't ask for a jury in these kinds of cases. They involve small amounts of money that can easily be handled by any trier of the fact, in this case, the justice of the peace.
Okay. Well, it occurs to me, just looking at this language, that we probably need to leave out the words "without a jury" in line 45, so that the plaintiff is always paying a $100 fee, and then if there's a jury request, whoever requested it gets to pay an additional $100 fee. I think that was your intent, wasn't it?
We had originally proceeded under just raising the fee for a trial to $100 from the original 17. I don't know, quite frankly, why it was bifurcated. In the past, it's been one fee either way.
So it was intended to be $100
either way. I wasn't present at the previous hearings for the amendment, so I couldn't tell you if anyone had that, nor was I present during the negotiations to tell whether that was a factor in that.
I mean, the way the thing's drafted now, it appears that if the defendant asks for a jury trial, he gets to pay the $100 fee. If he doesn't ask for the jury trial, then the plaintiff pays the $100 fee. That seems a little odd to me, but that may very well be what the
somebody who wants a trial has that option, they ought to pay for it, Mr. Chair, and that's, I think, the reason behind it. Is the defendant's right to ask for a jury trial. The plaintiff does not have that right in these cases. I don't. They can. But it, again,
they're not going to. I understand that.
Yeah.
Right. So it was the idea then that the total fee for a jury trial would be $200?
I cannot answer that. I know what this says. I'm not sure that was the intent. But again, I was not present when these matters were negotiated.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Leininger, please.
I just love to, in my from the perspective of a former Clackamas County Commissioner that ran a justice court that started one, I just want to note that from my perspective, the idea of modestly raising the fees at a level that everyone can tolerate is really reasonable, because operation of justice courts is a net drain on the general fund that counties have to operate other services. Having a justice court takes some of the pressure off the state court system, and it's funded through general fund dollars and fees. So, you know, it's a really reasonable concept, and if it's a modest ask that people can all accept, it's a really good idea, in my opinion.
Mr. Chair, Representative Leininger, it's also very convenient for the users, because many of these justice courts are not located in the county seat. Many of them are 100 miles away from the county seat, and for not only the plaintiff but the defendant to be able to go to a much closer venue to have their disputes adjudicated is convenient and very helpful to everyone involved.
Right. And I'm quite certain that that's true. Any other questions for any of these four? Representative Bentz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just for purposes of getting this out on the record in this particular committee. And the amount of the increase in the fees is not sufficient, shall we say, to completely pay all of the bills of the Justice Court. And the numbers I was given, for example, in Linn County, it was still some $30,000 short of paying all of the costs of the Justice Court. And that actually is a good thing from my standpoint, because the idea of the Justice Court was to have access to justice, and we didn't want to price many people out of that opportunity. It's important to me that we do see the broader group of all of us helping pay for some of that opportunity, shall we say. And I also understand on the collection side of things that we want to keep those costs down for other reasons. But is it your understanding that, indeed, as these fees were going up, the focus was on not completely recovering the entire cost, but on the cost of access? Was that taken into account? Because I noticed on some of these things it's gone from $40 to $90. From $6 to $9 and $6 to $20. In other words, it looks to me as though there was some thought mm-hmm. still want to maintain access, and that means the broader group of people are going to have to pick up part of the cost.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, that's correct. We proposed originally much higher fees, not as high as the circuit courts, but higher than the fees that were agreed upon in the compromise. Those fees did not even cover the costs of running the court, not only running the whole court, but even running the small claims section. There were several courts that told me that if this bill did not pass, they did not get an increase, they would either drop handling small claims or not being able to have to cut maybe some support, so the small claims would take even longer to go through the system because they just didn't have the personnel and the resources to manage that along with the rest of their docket, which includes criminal cases, FED cases, and other things that are part of the court system for justice courts.
Thank you.
If I may, thank you.
Yes, Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz. If you those figures, as I mentioned before, do raise eyebrows. But if you look at it further, in this case of a civil action in a justice court, while this bill brings the fees to $90, if they were in closer to the cost, the cost would be, or the price. The fee would be $125. In the case of small claims action, it does go from $28 to $35, but it would be closer to $40 if we were making this. And as I said, the general fund is still going to pay for a lot of what's going on in these courts. It just won't pay for as much. I would point out, too, that the language with respect to the jury trial and was in the original bill,
2355. My current plan, just based on this conversation, is to check with Representative Barker, the chair of the Judiciary Committee, and find out what his thoughts were about that particular provision that the committee passed, and see whether it requires some amendment or not. It seems a little strange to me that the fee is $100 either way, only the defendant gets to pay for it if he asks for a jury trial, and the plaintiff pays for it if no jury trial request is made. That may very well be what they intended, but I want to check with him to be sure that I understand it correctly, and that that's what they actually want. But it's your position that the fee for a trial should be $100 a day, regardless of whether it's a jury trial or a non-jury trial.
Mr. Chair, at least. I don't have the copy of the original bill, but at one point we suggested that without a jury it be $100, with a jury it be more.
I see.
And perhaps that's the perhaps in the negotiations or something that got wrapped up so that it's $100 either way, and the language just doesn't necessarily reflect that.
And we certainly don't want to go back and renegotiate that.
No, not at all. So if there should be some clarification, I can also check with my people, Mr. Chair, and verify. But I and I'll go back over my notes. I'm sorry that I was caught.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, we need to go on to other issues, but
okay.
I appreciate.
Thank you.
At least we have an issue that we can try to nail down, and we'll see whether we can move this bill. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2316 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 26. Is that one yours as well?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Senate Bill 26 is another one that comes to you from the counties. And Senate Bill 26, as you look at it, is about 8 lines, which one might be able to give it a very quick examination. What it does is it actually repeals a sunset date that was put on the
allowance for counties to use their federal forest money. This has been a history of this process. It started back in 2007 when the legislature enabled Douglas and Lane counties to do that with a sunset for 2014. And then you have it extended, and later sessions, the list of counties were expanded. You have in your OLIS both the history and also we have included reference to the ORSs that you have looking at to repeal, and the repeal would be for the Section 3 of Chapter 75 of Oregon laws. This is dated, I guess, February 25th, because this is what we also showed the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. It should have the title of the ORS 294 for Senate Bill 26. Mm-hmm. So if you look at that and you scroll to about the third page, and that in that middle of the page where it talks about note Section 3, Chapter 75 of Oregon Laws 2012, this is the section of the sunset of January 2nd, 2016. That this bill takes out and allows it to be non-sunsetted continuous.
Thank you. So the effect of the bill would be to remove the sunset on the rule that currently allows these, five or six counties to use road funds for rural patrol for their own sheriff. That's the essence of the law currently, as I understand
but
it.
But not the road fund that is highway road fund, state highway road fund.
No.
This is
no,
just the federal forest, reserve money.
Right. Gentlemen, Mr. Commissioner, thank you so much for coming to Salem today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committee members, good to see you. I'll defer to my Lane County partner here first.
Thank you. Chairman Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager here in support of Senate Bill 26. I think staff did a nice job of outlining what the bill does. It's a bill that's been in Revenue Committee a number of times, frankly, this topic of how to provide certain tools to counties that are facing fiscal distress. Staff indicated that we first got the authority back in the 2007 session, and the authority was granted at that point in time to Lane and Douglas counties, which share the distinction of really being the top two receiving counties of federal forest revenue in the United States of America. We both have two forests that are federal forests, national forests under the Department of Agriculture, and the ONC lands under the Department of the Interior. And Lane and Douglas sort of share various amounts of those particular forests. But there's a number of counties. There's 16 ONC counties, and then I think 33 of 36 counties that actually get federal forest revenue. Counties faced a particularly bad time under federal forest management here since the listing of the spotted owl back in 1990. We used to get revenue from federal forests in about 1999. Congress passed a safety net piece of legislation that replaced revenue from actual timber harvest to revenue that came from the Treasury. But since 2000, that has been it was fairly solid and flat funding until 2008, at which time Congress changed the authority and we started to get on a ramp down that was pretty precipitous, actually, in 2011 when there was a new formula established. The point being is that we lost about a quarter of our revenue from federal forest safety net legislation. And What that meant was that there was a upward pressure, especially on general fund. And that's why you see a lot of these counties that have looked to the public for public safety levies, because they were trying to figure out how to fund public safety. The bill that we were ultimately, after 2007, ultimately evolved to include seven counties. So there's Josephine, Curry, Coos, Douglas, Lynn, Lane, and Klamath counties, all ONC counties, all facing this upward pressure on their general funds to fund public safety. And one of the things that occurred over the course of these legislatures in that time period was how to deal with counties in fiscal distress. This became one of the tools for counties in fiscal distress, where they could take dollars that were earmarked essentially under Oregon law to go into the road fund from national forest lands. So national forest lands create a pot of revenue for counties that go into the county school fund and the county road fund. What this law did was said, okay, those dollars that go into the county road fund, you may transfer for some of them to for purposes of patrolling county roads. And over the years, like I said, a couple other counties came into the law. We redefined what it meant to patrol county roads. And there were also sort of this series of sunsets established. I think we've all hoped that counties would come to a new place and time under maybe some tax reform. We hope that Congress would act on federal forest management. And unfortunately, neither of those two things have happened. Senate Bill 26 would recommend that we just simply remove the sunset and allow counties to continue to use this tool to the extent that we have already. The bill passed almost unanimously in the Senate. There was a primary discussion on the Senate side was really should this be opened up to other counties, to additional timbered counties. As I said, there are 33 counties that receive national forest monies. We sort of already had that conversation really back in 2009 when the bill was opened up for other counties to come in. And I think at this point in time we were willing to have that conversation, but you know, this is a fairly controversial issue in counties. And some commissioners really just said, we don't want to have that conversation in our county, we don't want the authority, we're better off without it. In our case in Lane County, it has been particularly controversial. It is never easy to transfer money away from roads and into public safety. It's a conversation that occurs at our budget committee, at our annual budget deliberations, and the reason we don't have a commissioner or a sheriff here today is because they're in budget deliberations in Lane County as I'm testifying. I think I'd like to close just to point out that of the seven counties, fully four of them actually have levies on the ballot of one sort or another on May 19th. So these counties are trying to figure out ways to help themselves, and I think that nobody is really loves the idea of transferring these monies, but it is a tool. And it's been an effective tool. It's allowed in Lane County, for example, us to keep 24/7 patrol on roads in the county, and it really helped us in 2013 to be able to focus our public safety levy on jail only, and that was a very important piece of our argument in Lane County, was to say we are going out to the voters for some new revenue. It's for jail only. We didn't have to get into a whole conversation about funding the entirety of the public safety system. We are still exploring various tools, other tools that we can use to help support rural patrol in Lane County. And I think we'll continue to have those conversations over probably the next 5 to 10 years with the voters.
Thank you. Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, for the record, Roger Nyquist. I'm the chair of the Lynn County Board of Commissioners. We just passed a budget last week. For us, this provision in the law has been very good. What we've done for the last 3 or 4 years is we have included both $1 million transfer and $1 million loan from the road fund to the sheriff's office that we've not had to use. So although the provision is there and we've budgeted it, over the course of the year, we work hard and we don't spend out all of the budgeted expenditures, and we have an ending balance that allows us to not take that money. The budget we just approved includes the same provision. So in the event that you, the body doesn't see fit to pass this provision, we will be faced with the proposition of executing that $2 million transfer that we would prefer not to have to do. So for us, it provides some flexibility in budgeting. We're operating with really little to no contingency for the budget our size, although it moved up a bit this year. And this allows us the stability to be able to not cut services and use it as a contingency that at this point we haven't had to use.
Thank you. Questions? Yeah, Representative Whitsitt, please.
I was wondering, was there ever a contingency that these monies were to be paid back?
In our budget yearly, it included $1 million in transfer and $1 million in loan, and so that there would have to be a note to pay that money back if, in fact, we executed it, which is not a very attractive proposition for us.
So if I may follow up, have the other counties paid their money back that they've used all of the money according to the law?
I have no idea what anybody else is doing. I can't speak to that.
Chairman Barnhart and Representative Whitsitt, the law that the legislature passed, which was Senate Bill 496 during 2000 and it even went back before this one.
Yes.
Yeah. There was a provision that counties could treat this as a loan, an interfund loan, or not. And essentially, so in Lane County's case, we've simply transferred the money and there has not been a repayment. Counties that elected to do the interfund loan were required under the law to repay the loan within 3 years. And again, I can't speak to the details of other counties that may have done that, but the law does prescribe that they have 3 years to pay it back if they do decide to do it as a loan.
Mr. Chair, could we find out from the AOC what counties might be under the agreement to pay the money back and if they've paid the money back?
I think we can do that.
That would be great. And I was just wondering what source of dollars for some of the counties that are using their road funds do you anticipate, and I recognize you can't speak for everyone, but that they will have in the future to use for their road funds if they use it on the patrols? Some of these counties are huge and have hundreds and hundreds of miles of roads and very little source to replenish this if the funds are spent on patrols.
Just for us, again, we've not spent any of that money. Our county road fund balance has remained about $30 million throughout my time as a commissioner. I've served for 15 years. We don't have any easy answers. Our revenue goes up 3 to 5% a year. Our expenses go up 5 to 7% a year. So our solution to the math that we face is to build a better mousetrap every budget year in the way of efficiencies and reevaluation of all the services that we provide. And until something changes, that we will continue to do that. I would say that I also wear the hat of being the chair of the Cascades West Area Commission on Transportation in our region. And the funding of infrastructure is substantially challenged, and we all know that in the way of gas tax or whatever revenues available to do projects. And that's a bigger issue that has to be addressed for everybody, for all the roads. And so we feel like we're doing our part. We're being very prudent with how we execute our budget and spend taxpayer dollars.
I would just like to say this is very controversial. among the counties. They are, as you know, people within the counties are divided on whether they should be using these road funds to fund their patrols or not. And I'm from one of those counties that is extremely divided among the people in the county, whether they should be taking it out of road funds or, you know, trying to force something after 7 years. The story that was, we're going to have a different source of funding after 7 years, and now we're 7 years later, and we're asking for an extension again. So just for the record, it is very controversial within some of these counties among the population.
Thank you. Yes, please.
Just briefly, Chairman Barnhart and Representative Whitsitt, Lane County, the measure we're going out for in May is a vehicle registration fee to fund county roads. That conversation about road fund transfer and its relative impact on the need for that has come up in the community, and it's a dialogue that's continuing to occur. The voters will tell us, you know, whether they want to see the vehicle registration fee or not. It's, you know, in my mind, it really does come down, unfortunately, to a question of federal forest management. Those were the funds we had hoped would at some point in time come back. They haven't yet. And so what we're doing in Lane County is really trying to put in front of voters opportunities to help themselves. And we are trying to do that in a targeted manner and with reasonable requests. This will be our second effort of probably a three-pronged effort, and we're hopeful that it will be successful. But you're absolutely accurate. This has been a controversial issue in the community. And ultimately, we've still come before you asking for this elimination of the sunset, because we do think it's a tool that is still valid and valuable, and that conversation we're having with the voters is going to take, like I said, it could be another 10-year conversation.
Very good. Do you know whether all of these counties have asked or approve of this extension or this sunset removal? Do you know?
Chairman Barnhart, I have been in communication with each of the seven counties as we've gotten the bill written, as it's been heard, been keeping them up to speed, and everybody has, of all the commissioners that I've been informing, everybody has been delighted to see that it's advancing through the process. So none of the seven counties that I've encountered has said we no longer wish to be involved with this effort.
Right. This bill doesn't require that county road funds be spent on a sheriff's patrol, does it?
It just allows, the operative word is that they may be expended for patrolling of county roads.
Right, so it's still up to the commissioners and the voters as to ultimately, if they want to, as to whether or not to do this. And Lynn County, at least, has chosen a big maybe, and so far hasn't had to.
Correct. Mr. Chairman, committee members, in response to some of the discussion, the key to this thing and making it work like we have is teamwork.
Right.
And elected officials and department heads checking their egos at the door and ultimately delivering the best services possible to its residents with the resources that are available.
Of course, you have a decision to make every year, don't you? Is it more important to save this money in the road fund to use for road maintenance, repair, and construction, or is it more important to provide public safety in the rural parts of the county? And that's both a political and a moral and a gut check decision on the part of commissioners, isn't it?
Sure it is. And Mr. Chairman, in our case, what likely would happen would be we would cut services and then work just as hard and have been in a financial position at the end of that budget year that we wouldn't have had to cut those services, but the law requires a balanced budget, and we do that, and that's the purpose that this legislation fulfills for us.
In effect, this becomes part of your contingency if you need it.
It is our contingency.
It is your contingency.
By and large.
Thank you. It just occurred to me that most of the members of the committee don't know, I think, that Linn County regularly goes out for a sheriff's levy, law enforcement levy, every 4 years. Linn County is a conservative county. People there are very careful with their money, and yet the levy passes every time. Sometimes it's close, but it passes every time to provide the jail and other services from the sheriff. Isn't that correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's true. Linn County's had a law enforcement levy since 1982. We're now in the second year of a four-year levy, and we live and die by our performance every 4 years with the voters. And the levy regularly passes about 60-40. And the bind we find ourselves in is the compression is somewhat of an unknown. So our representation to the voters on what we can do with this money are based on some projection of that compression that may or may not have happened. Our levy this year is compressed $6 million, which is about 25%. And so here we are. Do we budget this road fund contingency, or do we go cut the services that just a year and a half ago we promised to deliver?
Thank you. And the compression issue is a different topic that the committee struggles with all the time.
Sure.
Appreciate it. Any other questions? Representative Smith-Warner, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to go back to the original source of the funds, which is the secure, the federal funds. Thank you. So two things. Number one, it was the federal legislation, if I may, Mr.
Please,
Chair.
Yeah.
Number one, it was the federal guidelines on what you could spend it for, on what the counties can spend it for, that the state law changes, or dare I say preempts.
I would say leverages.
Okay. Oh, but originally it was the feds who said, we're giving you this money and here's how you can spend it.
Correct.
And then the state said, and through this ORS, we said, well, actually you can use it for this.
Chairman Barnhart and Representative Smith-Warner, that's pretty good. This goes back to like 1905 when the federal forests were created, and Congress said, we want to deliver 25% of the revenue from federal forests, national forests, for the purposes of roads and schools. And that's all they said. And so you're right. Legislation at 294, I think it is, yeah, speaks to, okay, we'll do roads and schools, and here's how, 75% to roads, 25% to schools.
Okay, great. And then as my second question, that, as we know, that particular bill, that source of funding is constantly in peril at the federal level. I used to work for Senator Wyden, so I'm a little more familiar with what a battle it continues to be. So it as a source, I guess my question/comment is, we could remove this sunset, but we're still not even sure how much longer we're going to be getting these funds. Is that accurate?
Representative Barnhart, Representative Smith-Warner, that's right. If you'll committee will probably recall here 3 weeks ago when Congress was coming back from a break, the House had passed what they called the doc fix before the break. The Senate came back and passed it after the break, and it provided for two additional years of SRS. In the absence of SRS, we returned to that actual revenue harvest. And I'll just give you an example in Lane County what that would have meant. Under SRS, about $6 million into the road fund. Under actual harvest, we would have gone down to about $600,000 in the road fund. So we could be having a different conversation had Congress not provided for SRS in the doc fix bill. The conversation would be, we'd still like the authority. It's just that we have a lot less money in the toolbox with which to transfer.
Thank you.
Thank you. I will note, too, that in OLIS we have a letter from Kelly Minty Morris, Commissioner, indicating that the commission approves the bill. Senate Bill 26. Anything else?
I just want to say that the input into my office from the citizens is in direct contradiction to the commissioners, which will be what my vote is based on, or from the citizens.
Thank you. Anything else? Any other questions? Thank you very much. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 26, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2566. Chris?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2566 is the bill that prevents the income taxation for in cases of a disaster or emergency where out-of-state businesses or individuals come into the state and provide disaster recovery and emergency services. The bill, as discussed last time, the bill has an indeterminate revenue impact given the nature of trying to predict disasters and emergencies, and there's a minimal fiscal.
And the only effect is on income taxes.
Right.
And we had quite a conversation last time about exactly when this would be in effect, and I think we concluded that it was during the time of a declared emergency until the time that the emergency was declared to be over.
That's correct.
Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Representative Vance, are you ready for the motion?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, move House Bill 2566A to the floor of the UPass recommendation.
Representative Vance moves House Bill 2566 to the floor, the engross version with to the floor with a DuPass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Yes, Representative Vance.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to vote for it. I would say I went back and looked at the different states that have adopted this approach, and it strikes me that there are very few true volunteers that come to our state. I think it's more often a case of folks coming to our state because there's a job to be done, and they're still going to be paid for the most part for it. I would also say that the bill's somewhat inconsistent in how it approaches out-of-state people coming into the state to work, but nonetheless, in most cases, the bill makes sense. In some cases, if we have emergencies, such as the one we all fear that might happen, which will take years to repair, this bill may or may not be the proper approach to taxation of those who join us for 3 or 4 years to rebuild massive structures that may have been destroyed. But for its purposes, in short emergencies, which I think is what everybody was thinking, I think it's probably the right thing to do, and so do other states, so I'll be supporting it.
Thank you. Other discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? Seeing none, the motion carries. Representative Davis, will you and Representative Williamson fight over who's going to carry? And
sure.
All right. We'll put it down as both of you for now.
That sounds great.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2566. Let's see, what's your next one? Do you have any more on this one?
I don't have any.
On this list. Okay, we'll just go right down then. We'll open the work session on House Bill 2492. We're back to Mazin.
I'm back. 2492 is a bill that you heard previously, Mr. Chair. This is the bill about the Oregon Facilities Authority. And to refresh your memory about what the bill is asking you to do, the Oregon Facilities Authority finances projects for nonprofits, Oregon nonprofits. And it utilizes the ability of the state to do tax-exempt revenue bonds, and then passes that
in the form. So basically, it's a conduit type of bonding. This bill asks you to grant them the authority to be able to do the same type of financing for projects that are not necessarily all in Oregon, but they are connected into entities that do have Oregon headquarters and Oregon nexus. So that's what the bill that you heard, and they came and talked to you about it, and that's the authorization that they're asking you to give.
Thank you. And basically, it's the idea, as I understand it, is to allow the treasurer to handle the paperwork for a conduit bond, even though the project extends past the state lines.
That's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Representative Vance?
Chair, I move House Bill 2492A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Vance moves House Bill 2492 as A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Yes.
I'm just a no on the bill. So.
Thank you. Any other discussion? Yes, Representative Leininger.
I think I'm a no here in committee also. Thanks.
Ah, okay. Either of you want to say more?
No.
Okay. All right. I would simply note that the way I interpret this bill is that it allows an organization that is mostly in Oregon but also partly in another state to use the facilities of the state treasurer to keep its interest down and by using their facilities for this conduit purpose. And I think that's a useful public purpose to do that. All right. Is any further discussion? I think we better call the roll.
Representative Davis?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Leininger?
No.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Smith Warner is excused.
Representative Whitsitt?
No.
Vice Chair Vega Peterson?
Yes.
Vice Chair Vance?
Yes.
Chair Barnhart?
Yes. And with that, the motion carries and the bill goes to the floor with a due pass. Anyone have a burning desire to carry it? If not, I will carry it. Barnhart carries. All right. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2492, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2392. And I think that's Kyle's, isn't it? I'm sorry, 3492. Sorry, I'm misreading the numbers. House Bill 3492.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3492. We do have a dash two amendment that is up there in OLIS. And just as a brief reminder on the underlying bill, and then we'll get to the dash two.
There's nothing posted live for committee members.
Sorry?
There's no amendment viewable by committee members right now. Are we on a different bill?
No, there is.
I just got it up successfully.
The 2652. Oh, no.
I apologize.
I thought
we were going down the list. We'll come back to 2652. I'm sorry, I skipped that one.
Yes, so 3492, what the bill would do is it's providing an exemption for utility scale solar property. And then there would be an in-lieu fee equal to $7,000 per megawatt of the nameplate capacity of the solar property. The changes in the dash two would include cities, if the property is going to be within a city taxing district, to be part of the agreement. And there's also been a change in the distribution formula. I think the committee will remember originally it was based upon the percentage of the permanent imposed property taxes for districts that would be affected, where now it would be taking into account all the operating taxes, so everything excluding bonds. So the idea is the in-lieu fee would be based upon what the tax would otherwise have raised if it was done through the property taxes. There's also a change in the bill to include, essentially the idea is for a property that receives exemption under the SIP program would not be able to then receive exemption and lieu fee under this program. There's already a provision in the dash one bill relating to the red zone, the rural renewable energy development zone, from being able to double dip from that one as well. And then there's also a sunset date that was included in 2022 in the dash two amendments.
Okay. All right. Go ahead.
Well, I don't know if you want me to describe we do have the paperwork as well.
Please. We'll go into
that.
Yeah. So
the fiscal is indeterminate. We do have that up in OLS. And then the revenue impact, if you'll take a look, it does actually show a positive revenue impact. And there's a series of assumptions behind the revenue impact. And it's based upon, first is just the outlook of solar property or solar utility scale solar power development over between now and through fiscal year 2021. So that's kind of step one. And then the reason for the positive revenue impact is the assumption most of the properties that I could find that are kind of in the stage of where they look like they're going to be developed would also qualify under the rural renewable energy development zone. So they'd receive an exemption similar to an enterprise zone for 3 to 5 years. So if the assumption is the baseline, well, these properties would receive an exemption if under current law, then for the first 3 to 5 years, they would pay no tax under House Bill 3492 with the dash two amendments. Rather than receive that exemption for the first 3 to 5 years, they would start paying immediately based upon this $7,000 per megawatt nameplate capacity. So over the long term, there would be a loss in revenue, but over the initial time frame, it is a positive revenue impact because it's kind of from a floor of zero, more or less. There could be some community service fees, I believe, under the red zone. But that's the reason for the revenue impact. Spoke with LC on it. It doesn't make it a bill for raising revenue, so that's okay.
And the reason for that is?
Because from the basis, it's really, from how I made the revenue impact, it assumes another tax exemption would apply. There's no guarantee for that. And from existing current law, as normal property tax, it would be a revenue loss. So it's just a difference in two exemptions that would be available.
And it requires action by somebody else, doesn't it?
Exactly, yeah.
In this case, the developer and the county.
Yeah, so the developer would basically decide whether they want to use this one or the red zone, and then the county or a city, the requirement in statute is that they shall allow this. The only real lever that they have is on the number of years. Right now it's up to 20 years, but there would be a requirement if the solar developer says, I want to do this, it's not permissive to the county or the city on whether to allow it.
Well, but they could allow it for 3 days, and that
Correct.
Would take care of that, wouldn't
yes.
it?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
So they're not actually required. Mr. Let's see. Wendy, do you want to be heard? And then Mr. Brown to talk about the other topic. Please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson from the League of Oregon Cities. You'll remember at the first hearing, we testified in opposition to the bill, and you do have the dash two amendments before you that address a number of our concerns. The bill does now have a sunset of 6 years. That's in section three of the dash two amendments. It did add cities in cases where a project would be located in a county and within the city limits of a city. So we appreciated that addition. It did take care of some double dipping issues and made sure you couldn't get both the red zone and a SIP agreement exemption. That's in section 17A. And then it did fix the distribution. Instead of using permitter rates, in some cities and counties have zero permitter rates, it uses the taxing rate for the distribution of the fee. So we appreciated that. So those all are made. So we still have two concerns with the dash two amendments. It's the shall language for property tax exemptions or fee in lieu of. We don't like ever the state to be imposing an exemption or some sort of a requirement to abate taxes. So we would prefer that it go back to a may rather than a shall. I think in most situations, the county would agree to it. The city may as well, but it shouldn't be a shall as a matter of policy. And secondly, there's a penalty provision in the bill. So if the taxpayer who's supposed to pay this fee instead of the property taxes, if they don't pay for a year, then the exemption goes away and a penalty will be imposed and then property taxes assessed going forward. But the way the language is written, it says that the penalty would be distributed to the county. And so I'm just concerned that it could be read to only go to the county and not the other taxing districts. And so those are the two pieces that we still have concerns with. Been working with Mr. Bates on these issues, and he's aware of the two concerns that we still have.
Very good. And I think we asked you up to talk about land use issues.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Brown with Obsidian Renewables as a solar developer. And at the public hearing on this bill, there were some questions from members of the committee about siting solar projects appropriately on non-valuable farmland. And I'm happy to come back and report on what the status of the law is on that. We had three consecutive legislative sessions where solar land use bills were prominently discussed, and those were difficult discussions. There were a number of agreements and disagreements about that, but we did get to an end point, and the current law on solar siting is reflected both in a statute. It was last revised in House Bill 2820 in the 2013 session, and in the administrative rules adopted by the Land Conservation and Development Commission on solar siting on agricultural lands. Because it's an Oregon land use law, you all know that it's complicated. But here is what I think is a very workable and relatively simple summary of it. If the farmland is considered highly valuable farmland, then the solar project is restricted to 12 acres, which would be about 2 megawatts, unless you get permission from LCDC to have it be bigger, and that permission is called an exception. It's not easy to receive. No solar project has ever tried to get an exception. If it's not high-value farmland, but it's irrigated farmland, valuable farmland, then you're restricted to 20 acres. If it's agricultural land but not high value or irrigated, then it's 100 acres. So that'd be the dry farms in the Columbia area, as an example. Also, some of the dry farms in the Klamath would be another example. If it's grazing land, much of eastern Oregon, then it's 320 acres. To double down on those protections, if it's more than 100 acres on anything but grazing land, you also have to go to FSEC and get a energy facility site certificate. And if it's more than 320 acres on grazing land, you have to go to FSEC and get an energy facility site
certificate. And FSEC is?
The Energy Facility Siting Council, so the state agency. So
yes.
The county has jurisdiction until you get to the FSEC threshold, and then FSEC has jurisdiction. There's never been a solar project taken to the Energy Facility Siting Council because that's a pretty big hurdle to try to get such an exception.
That'd be a big facility too, wouldn't it, to take up
yes.
that much room?
Yes. Yes. It. Some of us hope that we do get some facilities that are 320 acres, but the largest project in Oregon so far was announced by PacifiCorp a week ago, and it's 5 megawatts. It's located on 40 acres, and that 40 acres includes the access roads and buffer zones, et cetera. So that's what size the projects are.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
At least to date.
Questions for either of these two? They're different topics, but yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure it's for either of these two, but one of the questions I had about this kind of an arrangement where it's a payment in lieu of taxes is how it would impact that county or city's the contribution to the state school fund.
because even though they are the payment in lieu of taxes is going to the governments for the whatever needs, I was not sure how that would impact.
Kyle, does part of this money go to schools?
My initial understanding would be that because it's based upon the permanent location of all the districts, that it would. I can double check just to make sure that for some reason it doesn't get lost in the translation. But the way it's distributed from the tax collector to the districts, it seems that that would still flow to the state school fund as normal.
And that was the testimony we heard.
Okay.
And that was part of the reason why we made the change in this amendment, was to make certain that we're talking about the actual taxes, not some kind of base rate.
Right. Chair Barnard, if I could add that.
Yes, please.
On page 2 of the Dash 2 amendments, it's lines 25 through 30 is when it's talking about the treasurer shall distribute the fee revenue collected under the section to each taxing district in which the project's located on the basis of the ratio. So that would include all of the taxing districts. If there was in a school, if there was a school district in the project area, it would be included. That's why we really wanted that. This provision rewritten, because it had permanent rate before, and many of the taxing districts have non-permanent rates and other levies.
Anything else? Yes, Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chair, if I can briefly respond to Representative Smith-Warner's question, because when we designed this bill, the concern about schools was a feature that we were very much aware of. The current red zone creates a payment that goes to the county general fund, and the county has discretion on how to apply it. And we chose instead to make sure that all the taxing districts shared in the money. Mm-hmm. So that's a significant change in philosophy that we wanted to implement into the bill, as we testified about previously.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate that, and that may suggest to us a potential amendment to the red zone at some later time, not part of this bill. Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, and I would also just like to clarify that while the Dash 2 has a sunset on the date in which for when these can be entered into, it does not bring down the up to 20 years that these agreements could be for. So you could do one the day before the sunset, but still win another 20 years.
That's correct. And I think the testimony we heard about that is that the power agreements and the financing and the property tax all have to line up in order for the developer to decide to go ahead with it. I think that's a fair summary of what your testimony was last time.
Yes, sir.
Okay. I would simply note that it's getting late. We're in May. If we have a mind to get this bill out of the legislature, my preference is to get it across the floor, and then if there are amendments that are needed to deal with the city's two remaining issues, mm-hmm. that they be addressed in the Senate. Representative Vance, what's your pleasure?
I agree with you. We should move it. So. Move the Dash 2 amendments.
Representative Vance moves the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3492. Further discussion? Objection to the motion? Hearing none, it's so ordered. Representative Vance? Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. It's on the bill.
All right.
Chair, I move House Bill 3492 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Vance moves House Bill 3492 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion, Representative Woodson.
I'm a no based on the long-term revenue impacts of this. I just will be a no on this bill.
Okay, thank you. Other Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to be, as they say, a courtesy no to highlight the that I really feel strongly about the shall as well. I can be a courtesy no here or a courtesy yes here. Effective way to raise that issue on the Senate side, whether it would be a courtesy no or a courtesy yes.
Thank you. And that might be a short speech on the floor, too, perhaps. Okay. Right, as okay. you like. Representative Ben?
I just want to thank everybody for their hard work on this bill. It should make an enormous difference in my district, I hope, for schools and local governments, because so much of my area is suitable for this kind of development. I must say it's hard to look at the 320 acres without laughing because it's such a modest, incredibly modest amount of ground. I can't count the number of irrigation pivots that one pivot covers 320 acres. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them over there, and they cover a mere modest fraction of the total amount of ground that's available, most of which is generating about $1 an acre in tax revenue. So the discussions today are interesting. I'm hoping that we see some development that illustrates just how much transformation this opportunity, this bill could work on my part of the state and in Oregon in general, and for the benefit of the state in general. So happy for the bill.
Thank you. I appreciate very much the bringing of this legislation. My approach is, my concern is a little different from Representative Bentz. While he's concerned about getting a little more money out of some of those scrub acres, I'm concerned about getting renewable power to fund our manage our civilization, so that we don't have to burn fossil fuels to do that anymore. There was a piece recently put on by Elon Musk of Tesla Motor Company, showing the total amount of space that would be required to generate all the electricity the United States needs using solar panels. And it covered a very, very tiny portion of the state of Oklahoma. That was where he picked to stick that spot. So I think Representative Bentz's point about very small spaces, very large facilities that don't take up any room because they're in a very large space, makes a lot of sense to me. Any further discussion? Representative Reed.
I just like that the comments you made and the comments Representative Bentz made kind of go together.
They do,
don't
they?
More power.
And that was on purpose.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you. Anything else? We'll take the vote now, please. I think we need to call the roll.
Representative Davis?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Leiter?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Representative Smith Warner?
No.
Representative Whitsitt?
No.
Vice Chair Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bentz?
Aye.
Chair Barnhart?
Aye. And with that, the motion carries. Who would like to carry this bill? Representative Bentz, I thought you might. Representative Bentz will carry, and with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3492 and open a work session on House Bill 2126, vertical housing. Kyle, that's yours as well.
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2126, the committee will remember, it was up for work session last week on the 7th. It does have a dash 3 amendment. We unfortunately didn't have the paperwork at that time. We do have all the paperwork up in OLIS now. The fiscal is a zero fiscal, and the revenue impact is no direct revenue impact. And the reason for that is that what the bill does with the dash 3 amendment, just to remind the committee, it is based on an existing exemption, property tax exemption. And so the bill would do two things. It would extend the sunset from 1/1/2016 to January 1st, 2026. It would make a definitional change, and then with the dash 3 amendment, it would allow any local taxing district to elect not to participate in the exemption. And that's a change from existing law, which is for the special districts have the ability to opt out. And even so, it's still a discretionary exemption to begin with on the part of the counties or a city. So that's the reason why there's no direct revenue impact associated with this bill, because it'd still take a subsequent at the local district level for any revenue loss to occur.
All right. Okay. So we have the dash 3?
Dash 3, yes.
All right. So what's your pleasure? We've talked about this quite a bit. Representative Bentz?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move the dash 3 amendment.
Representative Bentz moves the dash 3 amendment to House Bill 2126. Further discussion? Any objection to the motion? Seeing none.
Wait, sorry.
Yes, please.
Could you,
Representative Leininger?
Chair Barnhart, could you please repeat where we are in the proceedings? I'm sorry.
We're on House Bill 2126.
Right. Yes.
And we're looking. The motion is to adopt the dash 3 amendment.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm sorry. I should restate the motion, shouldn't I? Before I take a vote. Are you ready to vote on the bill, on that motion now?
The motion.
Right. The motion is the dash 3 amendment. Is there any objection to the motion? Don't see an objection, so the motion carries. Representative Benz?
Chair, I move House Bill 2126 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Benz moves House Bill 2126 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there now the discussion? Representative Leininger.
Thank you. I just wanted to note that I'm going to be a no on this.
And do you want to say any more?
Nope.
No? Okay. Any other?
I will also be a no.
Okay.
I don't want to say anything.
Okay, all right.
I'll need to announce. I'm also
going to
be a no.
Well, let's see. How many more no's do we have? I'm counting noses.
No, just
no's.
Noses.
Okay, all right. But again, no other comment. All right. I think we better take the roll again.
Representative Davis.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Leininger.
No.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative Smith-Horner.
No.
Representative Whitsitt.
No.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Megan-Peterson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Benz.
Aye.
Chair Barnhart.
Aye. And with that, the motion carries and the bill goes to the floor with a due pass. Who would like to carry this bill? Nobody's going to want to carry the bill. Okay. Well, I guess Barnhart carries again. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2126.
Oh, wait. Oh,
Johnson
oh.
will take
gotta,
it.
Johnson's going to carry. Oh, well, thank you. Get me off the hook. Representative Johnson will carry the bill.
I want to shorten our floor session, Mr. Chair.
I don't talk that slowly, do I?
It's the volume. It
wasn't about speed.
It's the number of words.
The number of words. All right. Representative Johnson will carry, and his speech will be very short. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2126. Let's go back and open the work session on House Bill 2652. And I think that's yours as well, isn't it?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right. And let's just, why don't you describe where we are on that one?
Yes, so House Bill 2652, we don't have any amendments or anything on this bill. We do have the paperwork at this time. It's a minimal fiscal impact. And the revenue impact is indeterminate. And the reason for that is a quick overview of the bill. It makes changes to the qualification criteria of the SIP program in that it changes the definition of rural area to mean an area located entirely outside of an urban growth boundary of a city with a population of 40,000 or more as the boundary is acknowledged on the date on which the application is submitted. So that differs from current law in that right now it's based upon rural area is 30,000 or more for the urban growth boundary as acknowledged on December 1st, 2002. So there's two changes. One, it increases that amount to 40,000, which does address there'd be two cities that'd be included that wouldn't otherwise qualify as the rural area. So it's a little more area in that case that could qualify as rural. And then the change from the urban growth boundary from December 1st, 2002 to when the application is submitted would encompass any expansion in urban growth boundaries of the different areas. So in that way, it could decrease the amount of area that would be considered rural. And just to remember, on the SIP program, whether you're in a rural or an urban zone, that changes the amount of property tax exemption you receive from $25 million or $100 million. Or, excuse me, that is subject to tax. If you're in a rural area, the first $25 million is subject to tax. And if you're in an urban area, it's the first $100 million. So if you change the amount of area that's considered rural, it could have some effects on the SIP program. And if you look back at just if these changes had been in place since December 1st, there would be a couple properties that would fall into this area where they wouldn't qualify in the rural area. Of course, the reason for the indeterminate is going forward, it would depend upon the location choices of any business. So if for some reason you make this change and the business would like to locate in a certain area that would now be considered an urban area rather than a rural, they could then possibly look for another area that would fit in the rural category that would suit their needs. So that's the reason for the indeterminate.
Okay. Representative Davis.
Kyle, can you explain again, because I read through it a million times, I still get confused on the effect on the cities in that 30 to 40,000 delta. We've got that. There's like Oswego, Kaiser, Grants Pass, Oregon City, McMinnville. So what would be the effect on them?
Yes, Representative Ace. So it's the two. It's Grants Pass, McMinnville. Those are the cities that all fall within that 30 to 40,000. But Lake Oswego, Kaiser, and Oregon City would be in the larger urban growth boundaries. of the metro area.
Because they're in metro. Yeah. Yes. So we're talking about Grants Pass and McMinnville.
So it's Grants Pass and McMinnville, and that's because they have right now what's considered rural is outside of 30,000 or more, and they're so making that change to 40,000 would now make within their urban growth boundary would be less than 40. If the city is less than 40,000, so it's
they would qualify for a rural SIP inside their.
Yeah. So the way I that's to help me think about it is just if the city is now less than 40,000, they're now it's a rural area.
Mm-hmm.
So it encompasses two more cities that would now be rural areas that otherwise.
And which cities were they?
It was Grants Pass and McMinnville.
Okay. Representative Whitson.
No.
Oh, I thought I saw it.
That's
right, Corson.
Other discussion? Representative Vega Peterson, do you have a motion for us?
Yes, I do. I move House Bill. Oh, I just lost my page. Just a second.
2652.
Thank you. 2652. I was looking at the list. House Bill 2652 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Vega Peterson moves House Bill 2652 to the floor with a do-pass. Discussion? Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to support the bill because I think the logic that is contained in it makes sense as far as the definitions and the timing, but I do think the discussion that we're having underscores the need for continued attention to tools that facilitate economic development and growth. The Strategic Investment Program is one of those things that works well, and I hope we'll keep that in mind as we consider other proposals.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be a no on the bill, although it's a close call. But here's the problem. The bill is crafted, doesn't really have much of an impact on my part of the world because we're not really in competition with Portland. We may be in competition with Boise, but we're certainly not in competition with Portland. And that would take in much of my district. What is of greatest interest to us is that, just as Representative Reed just mentioned, that this state do really, really, really well financially, and that we have the very best foundation for economic activity, and I'm not sure that this bill does that. What I want to be doing with this bill is attracting more and more and more business to those areas that are fortunate enough to be attractive to business, and so I am not interested in joining one side or the other in a battle between Hillsborough and Beaverton or whoever. I don't care. I simply want the business to come here. And so now I'm sorry to whoever's from those odd places. whoever. The point is, I'm not sure that this bill gets us there. I'm happy to work further on it because I do agree the SIP is a powerful tool. But that's why I'm going to be no on the bill.
Hey, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. And I think my sentiments were expressed quite well by Representative Reed, Representative Benz. It's a very close call for me, but I'm going to be a no right now, simply because I don't like the intent of things aren't fair because the economic growth is good on one side of the metro area, mm-hmm. and we're not getting our share on the other side. I think a more comprehensive discussion of making the SIP program work for the entire state is probably ripe at this point, mm-hmm. considering whether or not the $25 and $100 million thresholds are appropriate, considering a more comprehensive a look at rural and urban definitions. So for that reason, I'll be a no.
Thank you. Representative Vega Peterson.
Thank you, Chair. So I will be supporting this bill. As you know, we did a similar bill. I think it's the exact same bill last session. And I do think that the fairness piece is it, but I agree with the sentiment that we actually need to do something to look at the SIP program and as it's set right now, how much impact is it actually making in the most rural parts of our mm-hmm. state, mm-hmm. And whether that's changing the mm-hmm. some of the criteria on how much the investment is in order to qualify for the SIP in rural areas. I think that's a discussion that we should take up in this committee. But I think as this bill stands, I support what it's doing in terms of setting the boundary to more accurate boundary date.
Okay, great. And other discussion? Let me say that I agree very much with the sentiment of Reed, Benson, and Davis about the need for more comprehensive work on this whole topic. I think, however, that changing the date upon which this division is made from a date certain in the past to a date based on current situations, does more accurately reflect current reality, and therefore makes it more likely rather than less that we'll get to that comprehensive fix or reform that you would like. I would love to come up with some ways that we can analyze different approaches to economic development and ways in which the state can promote economic development that we can be relatively certain of, that are relatively inexpensive on our school fund, and that are effective, that actually work. That's a real chore to come up with all of those categories in the same place. I'd welcome it. So let's continue working on it. Other discussion? I think we better call the roll.
Representative Davis?
No.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Leininger?
Yes.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Representative Smith-Warner?
Yes.
Representative Whitson?
No.
Vice Chair Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Benz?
No.
Chair Barnhart?
Aye. And with that, the motion passes, and House Bill 2652 goes to the floor with a do pass recommendation. And I'm looking at the sponsors of the bill. I think we should ask Representative Gorsuch to carry. That's what we'll do. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2652. And I think we have one left, which is 2643. Let's open the work session on 2643. And colleagues, I'm not certain that we're going to move this bill today, but I wanted to have a conversation about it at least and see where we are. Kyle, that's yours as well.
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2643. So we do have the paperwork as an OLIS for the bill as the Angross version. We don't have an amendment or anything at this time. The fiscal impact is minimal, and then the revenue impact is initially there's a minimal revenue loss, and then in subsequent biennium it does increase slightly to about $200,000 for a total impact in each biennium. And the bill, just as a brief reminder, it makes changes to the enterprise zone, and it's really it removes the limit. Is kind of the two things that would have impacts on revenue. Is it removes the total limit on the number of enterprise zones, and it would allow counties, cities, or ports to become the designators of the zones. The framework for the enterprise zone, still the qualification requirements, and then also the zone requirements still exist, and that would be Business Oregon still have oversight on those areas. And I should mention Business Oregon is here to answer any questions as well if there are ones from the committee.
I think there are some, so. Yeah.
And then the change that, so the removal of the number of zones doesn't have a direct revenue impact, so that's not contained in the bill because it would be up to the local governments to decide whether they want, whether there's demand for more zones. In the past, when the number of zones has been increased, the limit, we have seen those new zones picked up. So there has been demand in the past for the new zones. Going forward, it would depend definitely on what the local governments decide. And the change that reflects an actual in the revenue impact is the change of the personal property tax exemption for the e-commerce personal property. So that's the change.
And what is that? What does that change?
So it's on page 17 of the bill. And under existing statute right now, there's requirements for property to be qualified property. And for personal property, it has to be worth, for e-commerce property, it can be worth $1,000 or more, can receive the exemption if it's in an enterprise zone approved for electronic commerce. Otherwise, it'd have to be worth $50,000 or more to receive the exemption. The change in the bill would make all electronic commerce property, whether it's in an e-commerce zone or outside of one and just in an existing enterprise zone, be subject to that $1,000. So if it's worth more than $1,000, then it could receive the exemption. So it's that change of, say, like a property that is worth $25,000 is e-commerce that's outside of an e-commerce zone. Currently, it wouldn't be receiving the exemption. With the change in the bill, it would now receive that exemption.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Kyle, for all your work on this. What qualifies, and maybe this is for Biz Oregon, what qualifies as e-commerce property?
Why don't we get Biz up and
Art Fish.
Oh, there, yeah, please. And let the experts answer the question.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Representative Davis, my name is Art Fish with Business Oregon. It's a great pleasure to be here and to hopefully address your concerns and issues. What is e-commerce? Well, e-commerce is, as defined in the bill, actually, on page one under definitions, I think is a very helpful place to go. But, I need those glasses here. E-commerce means engaging in commercial or retail transactions, predominantly over the internet or computer network, utilizing the internet as a platform or transacting business or facilitating the use of the internet by other persons for business transactions, and may be further defined by the Oregon Business Development Department by rule. And then in the stuff related to the tax credit, the income tax credit that is kind of the point of fame for the e-commerce elements in the enterprise zone, I think it's further treated here, or maybe that's there, where it talks about order fulfillment and stuff like that, but I can't quite find that, or maybe I just read that in there. But it is like e-commerce and things going over the internet. The property in question here relates to personal property. In Oregon, a lot of machinery and equipment that's relatively immovable is treated as real property, so all of that generally qualifies in enterprise zones, provided that, those in building improvements are so much. You do have these special thresholds that have always applied to, I shouldn't say always, as long as the Enterprise Zone Act has been around, to items of personal property. That is very movable stuff. And they've had to cost over $50,000 per item unless used in the production of tangible goods, in which case the threshold was as little as $1,000. Then with the e-commerce zones, in addition to the income tax credit, they also allowed personal property associated with e-commerce to also qualify per item of personal property at as little as $1,000. The reason, I suppose, is that, like tools and other things that might be in a production or manufacturing setup, the thought was that these computers and other elements would be integral to actual e-commerce activity that was then made eligible in those, at least especially eligible in those 15 enterprise zones. And then this bill, as introduced, would extend that to all other enterprise zones. So you might say, though they couldn't offer the tax credit, the income tax credit to e-commerce businesses as a whole, they could at least be a little more attractive to, say, e-commerce activities or related things that were particularly heavy in a lot of these personal property investments. So maybe a service center, data centers that have a lot of things. We've ran into companies in marketing the e-commerce zones, which are, pretty interesting to a lot of different types of businesses. And some might like the income tax credit, some may not have any use for it. But they may have a lot of this personal property, and that ability to qualify it more easily and certainly down to that $1,000 threshold becomes, can add up to a fair amount of savings. And so I think originally in Eugene and Springfield, they were approached by some data center type developers, that would open up centers that companies could bring their servers to. And they were saying, we'd really like you to be an e-commerce zone, not so much for the credit, we don't care about that, but rather for this personal property treatment. And so I think that's how it got to people in Eugene Springfield, Representative Lively, who you heard from, and why it ended up in his bill.
Thanks.
Thank you. Other questions? Yes, Representative Woodsett.
I am not understanding why this doesn't have a revenue impact, because
you're asking my question. Thank you.
Okay.
I appreciate that.
Okay. given that we're going from a limited number to an indefinite number of these enterprise zones, I don't understand. So go ahead.
Yes, Representative Witsit. The reason for that is it's the direct revenue impact. So by making the change in the bill, it then removes the limit. But that doesn't automatically create more enterprise zones. It would be subject to the county, the city, or the port district to then designate those. And that's why there's no direct revenue impact. If there are more zones designated and more property receives this exemption than otherwise would, there certainly would be a revenue impact at that point.
Okay.
But it's a secondary effect, and that's why it doesn't show up in the revenue impact.
You have thoughts about that question?
Yes. Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt, members of the committee. I would just comment. I mean, first of all, I agree with staff in, as far as how minimal it might be at initially. You know, this bill takes effect sometime this fall if it were passed. If companies react in time to get property finished and in service before the end of this year, they might be able to claim it next year. Otherwise, you know, it doesn't have much of an effect until 2017, in which case the property tax year is in the whole other biennium. Going down the road into the next biennium, I would agree with staff. I mean, it's just so speculative, I suppose. I think what I communicated to staff in our sense, and I would have put down some sort of minimal thing in at least the next biennium or so, is, you know, we're somewhat saturated with enterprise zones. I'm not sure there are many places left that could qualify, that would want an enterprise zone, and that don't already have one, of course, you know, because we have so many. And so what ones would occur, I'm not sure, would have a great deal of business activity. It certainly wouldn't happen perhaps quite this in time for the next, for the current upcoming biennium. But I think over time, I mean, the idea is that, you know, there'll be more zones. Some cities, Philomath, Lake Oswego, some other places that are lacking may come forward and seek one of these, and hopefully they'll get some use out of it. So I think there should be some revenue impact. I just think it's kind of in that indeterminate realm of, you know, what it would really mean, and that it might be fairly modest compared to a lot of the more usable, developable areas that already have enterprise zones.
How do we get an e-commerce zone? How does that happen?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, do you want one? Well, what we do is, of course, we need to come to
this. If I did want one, how would I go about doing
it? Well, first of all, you might want to come to this body and ask, because there are only 15 allowed. Okay. And
Does this bill change that?
No. It does not.
And how many do we have now?
15. And they've all been designated. So it's a little bit difficult. Right now, for example, we have a zone that is terminating that has had one since the early, you know, one of the first four, I think, from 2001. You know, so we go from 4 to 15. And you did add 5, I believe, the legislature, collectively, mm-hmm. just in 2013 or 2012 or something. Or 2012, actually 2014. I think it was just the mini session.
Oh.
Yeah, just that. And so we have a competition, or we wait till there's a compelling business if we only have one or two in the hopper, like we might have after this zone terminates that's had one for many years. Under the bill, it would just become a very much a first-come, first-serve thing. So we just have to figure out as a department how to sort of officiate that under the bill. But right now, it's really just depends on when zones that already have them terminate, and we kind of hopefully throw it out to all the other zones that may want one. And there is considerable interest among the other existing enterprise zones for these designations of e-commerce.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Whitsitt.
Okay, so I'm just looking in the summary, and maybe you can refer me into the bill where it says eliminates numeric limit on number of enterprise zones that may be designated at any time. That would seem like that means an unlimited number if it eliminates the numeric number on or numeric limit on.
What? Where are you looking?
That's right in the summary, and so. Am I looking at the
board? Yeah, Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt, members of the committee. I'm not sure if it actually states that outright. What it would do is it would eliminate the effect. It would eliminate the language that currently limits the how many we can have in the state, across the state. And so, in effect, places further jurisdictions could come forward, maybe in Klamath, Chiloquin, or whatever. I mean, there just aren't a whole lot of places left. So I think you're right. It would become, I think, as the summary says, unlimited. But just on the basis of expectation, I can't imagine that all, you know, we have 120, almost 120 cities already. The other 120, very few of those, I believe, are interested and eligible for this. So I think that's why there's somewhat modest expectation of use. I mean, over time, yes. I mean, we have five applicants right now for four spots. There's a few places that contact us that, you know, are sort of still considering it. But I think it's just a matter of expectations that it wouldn't be heavily utilized except, you know, over a very long period.
Thank you. Other questions? Colleagues, it's not my intent to move to work the bill today. I wanted to have this conversation, and please be in contact with me about the issues that are of concern to you about this bill and what we might do to make it more acceptable to those of you who have already told me they're not currently supportive. But now's your chance if you have any more questions for Mr. Fish. I don't see any. Thank you very much. We very much appreciate your testimony. With that, we'll close the work session.
Always my pleasure.
On House Bill 2643. Colleagues, if we get back to this, we'll reschedule it. And we've done everything else, haven't we? Yeah, okay. Yeah. So I don't need to move anything forward with that. Thank you for staying late. I appreciate it. Committee is adjourned.